There is a passage in Matthew's Gospel which, if understood and properly applied, can accomplish a great deal in keeping the church a harmonious, loving, supporting family group. And yet that instruction seems often misunderstood, is often avoided, and even when it is invoked, it too often doesn't bring the results it was intended to bring. Which passage am I talking about? Well, maybe you're already ahead of me. I'm talking about Matthew chapter 18 and verse 15, which says, "If your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he listens to you, you have gained your brother." Just a couple of lines. So what can be so difficult in that? Well, firstly, as in all Bible study, we need to put that passage into some form of context. That 18th chapter of Matthew begins with what has been an often repeated discussion, perhaps more than a discussion, a debate, or probably more accurately, an argument among the disciples about which of them should be in the ascendancy over the others. This time, having been unable once again to come to any sort of agreement about it, they brought the question to Christ. It says in verse 1, Matthew 18 and verse 1, "At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, 'Who is the greatest, or who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?'" Now, this wasn't a technical question about, do you think it'll be Moses, or do you think it could be Elijah, or do you think it could possibly be... No, they meant, which of us do you think is going to be the greatest? And each one in his own mind was sure that he knew the answer to that question. We should remember that there was a lot of feeling amongst these followers on this matter. Tempers could become frayed when this kind of ambition and self-elevation began to run rampant. Before we go on in Matthew 18, I'd like to just look at another occasion when this argument bubbled to the surface. If you turn over to Matthew chapter 20, Matthew chapter 20, and beginning in verse 20, we're told that then the mother of the sons of Zebedee, James and John, of course, came up to him with her sons. Kneeling before him, she asked him for something. She didn't tell him what it was she was going to ask for. She just more or less, I guess, said, "Would you do something for me?" And he said to her, "Well, what do you want?" It wasn't anything much, just a small favor, nothing really worth mentioning. She said to him, "Say that these two sons of mine are to sit one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom." "I don't really want much. I mean, it's a simple thing. I just want my two boys to be right at the top of the tree. Under you, I want them to be first and second in the kingdom. That's all. It's just a little thing I'm asking, you know." And he said to her, "You do not know what you're asking." Now the boys were with her, and he turned to them and he said, "Are you able to drink the cup that I'm to drink?" And they said to him, "Yeah, we're able. Yeah, No problem. And he said to them, well, you will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and at my left is not mine to grant, but it's for those for whom it's been prepared by my Father. Notice this, though. And when the ten heard it, when the other ten heard it, they were indignant at the two brothers. And then, of course, Jesus calls them over and he talks about, look, you know, outside of the church, outside there in the world, being in charge is a thing to be sought after because it gives you the opportunity to lord it over other people. He said, it shouldn't be like that with you. He said, I mean, if you really want to score brownie points, if you like, with God, you become a servant. You take on the role of a servant. It's interesting that that Greek word that's translated indignant, it's a word, agonakateo. It's in Strong's Concordance, number 23. It can include in its meanings feel angry, became incensed, became very much offended. So this argument, this exposition of raw ambition, caused a great deal of feeling. It caused some very raw feelings and could cause offense. And that's true whenever it happens. When this sort of thing happens, when people let their human nature run unchecked, there's always a danger that some are going to get hurt, some are going to become offended. And it's interesting that Jesus tells them that what they need to do is to replace their self-assertion with an attitude of humility and seek not to dominate the others, but to serve the others. If we go back to Matthew 18, he begins to talk to them about the need for great humility as we deal with one another to avoid causing offense. Notice in verses 2 to 6 of Matthew 18. Matthew 18, 2 to 6. And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it'd be better for him to have a great millstone fastened round his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. So he's putting a great deal of emphasis on not causing someone else to stumble, not giving offense, not by your attitude and your self-elevation to cause other people to get upset or to sin or to become offended. He then goes on and talks to them about, on top of that, you need to be very careful about not sinning yourself. He says in verses 7 to 9, woe to the world for temptations to sin. For it's necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. And if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life crippled or lame than with two hands or two feet to be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, then tear it out and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into the hell of fire. He's not really talking about maiming yourself, blinding yourself. He's talking about an attitude of mind that will do anything that is necessary to avoid sinning. So he's telling them, now you need to be an awful lot more careful about the way you deal with one another. You need to have an awful lot more humility. You don't want to go offending each other. It's a terrible thing if you really cause somebody else to stumble. And it's a terrible thing if you begin on a path of sin. And whatever causes you to go down that path, you be ready to just cut it out of your life. Take whatever action is necessary to get back onto the right path. Hopefully, we can begin to see a flow here in this 18th chapter. These are not random things. Jesus is developing a theme of pivotal points that have a great bearing on successful interpersonal relationships within a group. Following right on in that flow, he now addresses a situation where somebody within the group has either engineered themselves or has been engineered into a position of isolation from at least some of the members of the larger group. He addresses this point using, speaking in physical terms, using the analogy of a shepherd's flock of sheep from which one has wandered away. Remember, as we read this, he's not talking about sheep, or he uses that analogy, but he's still on the same theme. He's talking about interpersonal relationships. He says, "See that you don't despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who's in heaven." He says, look, you just be very careful the way you treat one another, the way you deal with one another, the way you relate to one another. Be very careful. And then he says, what do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them's gone astray, doesn't he leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly, I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it's not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. The implication is very clear. In God's eyes, if someone gets himself or herself into a place they shouldn't be, whether through their own fault or as a result of things others do, then in God's mind, what needs to happen if we have the mind of Christ is that we should feel a compunction to go and get them back to where they need to be. And the image that he wants us to have in our mind is that of a shepherd who has gone to the rescue of one of his sheep and brings it back, if necessary, lovingly cradled in his arms. This is the background that we need to have in mind as we better seek to understand this passage about going to a brother. So let's look at that passage a little more closely. We're told that this course of action should be invoked if your brother sins against you. The Greek verb that is translated sins here is the verb hamartaneo. hamartaneo. It means to miss the mark, to sin, to commit an offense. The implication from the text as you read through it is that whatever the problem is ongoing. The verb is said by Strong's to be active. That means ongoing. And as we read on, we get the sense that what's required on behalf of that individual is to acknowledge the problem and to change. So I want us to be very clear. When it says, if your brother sins against you, this is not talking of a one-off comment. This is not talking of somebody who's had a hard day and has said something nasty to you that they shouldn't have said. This is not talking about a one-off thing that's upset you. This is talking about an ongoing problem, not an isolated incident. I want you to think of this as well. The New Bible commentary supplies this here. It says, the words against you were probably not part of the original text and unhelpfully restrict the scope here. Response to personal injury, it says, will come into focus in verses 21 to 35. Here, it's the brother or sister's danger, not any effect of his sin on me personally, which is at issue. If you were to look at the account in Luke's Gospel, you will see this phrase, against you, isn't used. Luke 17 and verse 3, Luke 17 and verse 3, it says, pay attention to yourselves. If your brother sins, rebuke him. And if he repents, forgive him. It doesn't say against you. And the feeling is that that phrase against you wasn't in the original Greek. Incidentally, that phrase that's used here in Luke, pay attention to yourselves, probably means more than just look out for yourself. The Bible Exposition Commentary supplies here, this means, this expression, pay attention to yourselves, this means that we should lovingly watch over each other and do all that we can to keep each other from sinning. So when you begin to take this on board, you see that we need to take a somewhat wider view and not merely excuse ourselves from taking action if we see someone drifting into a pattern of sin, and we can't say, well, it's not directed against me, so it's got nothing to do with me. Yeah, I know he's kind of doing this, but, you know, he's never done anything to me, so none of my business, mate. No. We have a responsibility to one another. We are one another's keeper. We might make mention again at this point the timing of such helping intervention. I mentioned that all the indications are that the sin being spoken of is more of an ongoing situation rather than a one-off slip. You know, we're all human beings, and as such, you and I are spiritually a work in progress. That means there will probably be many times when we make mistakes, when we miss the mark ourselves, when we say things that we shouldn't have said, or at least say things in a way that we shouldn't have said them. If we were to each take it upon ourselves to go to our brother every single time we consider their performance to have been not what it should be, then I'd suggest that since our ability and accuracy in seeing faults in others is so highly developed, we might spend our time doing little else. You would find that after services, you wouldn't be found talking around. You'd be forming neat queues, waiting to bring some slip, some fault, some look, some innuendo to your brother. It's not supposed to be that. It's you see someone who is drifting into an area of missing the mark, and you're concerned for them, and you want to try, like that shepherd who goes off to find this lamb that is strayed, you want to bring them back. It's not a one-off thing. Don't you get the flavor of that when you read that passage that we've read several times before from Matthew chapter 7, the first five verses. Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 to 5. Jesus said, "Judge not that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you'll be judged. And with the measure you use, it'll be measured to you. Why do you see the speck that's in your brother's eye, but you don't notice the log or the plank that's in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there's a whole log in your own? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you'll see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye." Jesus isn't saying that we should never go to offer help, but that our emphasis should be that ensuring that we are truly able to help first. Perhaps in thinking about when should I go to my brother alone, another way of saying it's not a one-off thing, it's when there's a series, when someone is drifting into an area that they don't want to be in. We need to, as our friends across the pond might say, cut one another a bit of slack in this regard. You know, we have to realize that we probably all make mistakes. And when we do, we also should realize that, you know, people in the church who have God's Spirit will usually find that when they've made a mistake, when they've said something, and they know they've been a bit harsh in what they've said, when they know they've hurt someone, when they've done something that has hurt someone, God's Spirit working in their lives will usually, as we say, prick their conscience. And they'll recognize that. And they'll correct the problem themselves. We need to give people a little bit of time. Cut them, as the Americans would say, a little bit of slack, to let that process work. The kind of thing that's being spoken of in Matthew 18 as something that we should address with a brother is an ongoing problem that they seemingly cannot see. And if that problem is allowed to go on unchecked, it's going to cause them lasting harm. The next part of the instruction about going to a brother is that we should go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. Now, everything that we've looked at up to this point should be shouting at us right now about the manner and the attitude of our approach. Great humility. Great humility. A desire not to want to hurt and not to want to cause any offense to this person who is already hurting themselves. An attitude of gentleness, an attitude of care and love. I want you to notice how Paul put it when he was writing to the Galatians. In Galatians chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression," and when it means caught, it doesn't mean somebody spotted them going into a cinema to watch a picture they shouldn't have been watching. It means they are caught up in. It means they have somehow begun to do something that really represents missing the mark. They're caught up in it. They're entangled in it. It says, "You who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. And keep watch on yourself, lest you too be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ." So what do we take from that? Well, if we see someone who is just getting involved in things that they shouldn't really be getting involved in, is missing the mark, we should go to discuss the matter in a spirit of gentleness. Not a pretense of gentleness. No, a spirit of genuine gentleness. Not only is this the right way to go, it also happens to be the way with the very best chance of success. We should go seeking to lovingly help the individual the way we ourselves would like to be helped if the roles were reversed. The word restore in that passage from Galatians, "You who are spiritual, restore such a one." That word restore, the Bible Exposition Commentary tells us, is a Greek medical term. It is a medical term that means to set a broken bone. Can you imagine the patience and the tenderness and the gentleness that you've got to use if you are trying to set a broken bone? It makes the point, though, that we cannot just say, in that case, "Well, if it's that hard, I'd rather just not do it." We have a responsibility to really try to help one another in such circumstances. We are, it tells us, our brother's keepers. James also addresses such a situation. James chapter 5, verses 19 and 20. James 5, beginning in verse 19. James chapter 5, verse 19. It says, "My brothers, if anyone among you wanders from the truth and someone brings him back, let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and cover a multitude of sins." And that expression that James uses, "wanders from the truth," again emphasizes that this is an ongoing situation. It's not talking about a one-off mistake. Somebody has dropped their guard, has said something they shouldn't, done something they shouldn't as a one-off thing. It's an ongoing situation. It's the beginnings of what could ultimately become a falling away that would put the individual into great danger. And we should note from what James says here that going to them, the purpose of the intervention is restoration, not condemnation. You know, I've seen this done, where someone goes up, the face is stern, and the eyes are steely and focused, and it's, I want to talk to you about something. And you can see the whole attitude is a one of condemnation, indictment. I know what you've done, and I'm here to tell you. I mean, I've seen it happen, honest. Probably done it. It's not condemnation we're looking at. What Christ is putting forward is restoration. We're not going to argue with the individual, but to try to help to bring about that restoration. Yeah, you might go, and if you get into an argument, there's always the possibility you might win the argument and lose a brother forever. The image of the shepherd lovingly bringing back the sheep that had wandered off should never be far from our mind. Perhaps another thing to keep in mind as we may enter such a situation is that our assessment of what's happening in this person's life might be wrong. We might think someone is backsliding in some way, but we might just not be in possession of all the facts or know the circumstances. You know, sometimes we hear something that someone says, and we listen to what they've said, and they said, we say, I know what he said, but I know what he meant as well. You know, as human beings, we have this tendency to want to read between the lines. That's akin to imputing motives. I've had people say that to me. I know what you said, but I also know what you meant. I said, how do you know what I meant? You a magician? You a mind reader? Have you taken on a course at the local technical college on, you know, mind reading? I meant what I said. No, you didn't. You meant. And we can get it wrong. So this is another reason why when we go, it needs to be with gentleness and with meekness. It has to be that way in such situations. It also says we must go alone. And for some reason, as human beings, we find that simple instruction extremely difficult to embrace. There is a sad side of human nature that seems to want the failings of others widely known. After all, doesn't it make a nice, juicy tidbit of gossip? Yeah. Do you know what I saw Jerry Ramsey doing yesterday? Did you? I'd never thought it of him. Ears are suddenly pricked. Did you? Tell me more. He went where? No. It's human nature in the raw. He didn't go anywhere, by the way. He was busy making a box. When people fail to do this, when they see someone drifting a little bit into a area they don't want to be in. And they don't go alone. They talk to other people first. And when they're confronted with that, when somebody says, well, why didn't you go on your own? Why did you talk to him and her and him and this one over here? Why did you do that? They usually come up with all sorts of excuses for having done so. They'll say things like, well, I just wanted to see if anybody else had noticed what I'd seen. See? That's why I didn't bother with going alone. Or some get quite angry and say, surely you're not trying to suggest that I can't talk to my friends. Well, I'm not suggesting anything. Christ said, you go alone. Well, I did go alone, but I just talked to Fred and Charlie and Jim and Mary and, you know, before I went. No, that's not what he meant. That's not what you're supposed to do. Somebody else say, well, I just thought that I'd tell the minister about it. That's not what it says. It doesn't say, if you see someone getting into a difficulty in their lives and drifting into a path of missing the mark, tell the minister. It doesn't say that. Unless you've got a different translation. Some people say, well, yes, I know I told a few people about it, but I did it in the strictest of confidence. I told them, I'm telling you this in strict confidence. It would seem as well that the temptation to involve others is even greater if the person's misdeeds have resulted in ourselves being hurt or offended in some way. And that just ramps up the stakes and another feeling takes over. This time, it's this overwhelming urge that we have to tell of that hurt in order to get sympathy or have other people on my side. Do you know what she said to me? I can't believe what she said to me. I mean, the way she's been treating me lately, I just can't. Oh, never. Did she do that? She calls herself a church member. What we're looking for is getting people on my side. And if you can get the minister on your side, so much the better. If any of those excuses you begin to think is a reasonable justification, then you need to think about why we are told to go alone. You can all probably recite by heart that scripture that is called the Golden Rule, given by Christ, Matthew 7, verse 12. Whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them. For this is the law and the prophets. We have to ask ourselves, if I was the one with the problem, would I really want that failing to be publicized? I've seen people's failings discussed with others in absolute privacy. I'm only telling you this in confidence. And I've seen how those others have gone to others in confidence, in total privacy. I don't want you to pass this on until you're getting stories coming back from far and wide about what this individual has supposedly done and blackened their character. Would you want that to happen to you? We're told in the Bible that love covers a multitude of sins. James quoted that in that verse that we read, James 5, verse 20. It's also mentioned by Peter, 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 8, Peter says, Above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. Both of these men, James and Peter, were actually quoting from a verb in the book of Proverbs that offers us a thought-provoking contrast. In Proverbs 10 and verse 12, Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 12, it says, "Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all offenses." It's an act of loving concern for the individual to do exactly what Christ said and to keep the matter exclusively between yourself and the one that you're trying to help. To go around discussing the problem with others, whoever they may be, or whatever excuse you may use for doing so, it's going to cause problems. Could possibly cause strife and possibly end up even causing division within the church. It is the very opposite of an expression of love. A similar thought is expressed in Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 9. Proverbs 17 and verse 9 says, "Whoever covers an offense seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates close friends." Covering an offense by not discussing it with others is an expression of love and therefore promotes love among the group. Again, we're told that repeating or gossiping about the failures of another is bound to bring problems within the group. And this group we're talking about is the church. I'd just like to go back to one of those excuses that I mentioned for not going to a brother exclusively. And this is the one about, well, I knew about this, so I went and told the minister. Okay? Some of us find going to a brother difficult and find it a bit embarrassing to do. So it seems easier to merely drop a word in the minister's ear and feel we've done everything that we're supposed to do. We'd be wrong. We'd be wrong to think that. Why? Well, as we've been reminding ourselves, that isn't what Christ told us to do. He didn't say that. He didn't say, if you see a brother sinning, just pop out and tell the minister. He said, go to him on your own. Nobody else. Don't involve anybody else. Now, I would say that if a situation's arisen where you really feel someone is making some serious mistakes in a way that signifies that they need some help, and you're not sure how to proceed, then talk to the minister about how you should proceed, but keep the individual's identity out of it altogether. It's not a case of, well, I'm getting really worried about Charlie over here and I've got to go and see him. Can you give me any advice? No, you've already broken what Christ said. If you go to the minister and say, look, there's something that's coming up and I need to go and talk to somebody, following the instruction in Matthew 18:15, I don't want to talk to you about who it is, but I just need some advice. Can you give me some guidelines to help me to achieve success in doing this? He doesn't know. He'll give you the right advice, hopefully, and give you the right guidelines. There is one other person that you should discuss it with, though. before we go, we should always get help and guidance from God. As Mr. Adair was telling us, tell God what you're trying to achieve. Ask God for the right attitude and the ability to find the right words to gain success. Ask God to help the person that you're going to go and talk to respond in the right way. Ask God for the outcome to be the restoration of that person from the point of danger they find themselves in. That's the one person you can talk to, because he already knows. Nobody else. But what if they just won't listen? Or what if you go and they give you the proverbial flea in the ear? Well, I would say that this should be a rare occasion among converted people. If, and I do underline this, if everything that's been said up to this point has been carried out in the right frame of mind. However, Christ does give some further instruction. He says in Matthew 18 and verse 16, if he doesn't listen, if it doesn't work, if you're not getting through, then take one or two others along with you, so that every charge may be established by the evidence of two or three witnesses. This is a reference to a place in Deuteronomy where it tells us that matters ought to be established before two or more witnesses, Deuteronomy 19 and verse 15. However, the wording comes out here and makes it possibly sound this step sound a bit more severe than we should see it. You know, I read that and it sounds a bit more like coming with a union delegation. Right, lads, here he is. Before these witnesses, I now charge you. You know, it just sounds a bit like that. The Bible Exposition Commentary suggests it's more like asking some others to help to accomplish what we haven't been able to do on our own. And what were we trying to do on our own? Restore, not indict. Restore, not condemn. Another commentary speaks of widening the discussion while bearing in mind that the overall objective is not recrimination and indictment, but restoration of the individual and of your relationship with them. Sometimes, when a matter hasn't been sorted out between just two people, sometimes just the pressure of having one or two more join in the discussion can serve to focus the thinking and exert a gentle pressure to reconcile the matter. We then come to the question, okay, you've gone, you've really made the very best try you can to bring this person back from where they are, restore them, get this whole thing sorted out, and it hasn't worked, and you want to take step two. So now you ask the question, who then should be invited into the discussion? Well, I have some suggestions. It should not be your closest friends or family or someone you feel will automatically take your side. If you're going to involve one or two other people, it should be someone or some people that you both respect for their integrity, for their wisdom, and for their impartiality. In my opinion, it would be better not to make an attempt before the meeting to pre-program the people that you're going with. Well, look, I've had a bit of trouble. You know, I need your help here because I haven't been able to get him to see. He's doing this, and he's all of a sudden their minds are already aligned, aren't they? It might be a better thing to do is to say, look, I need you to come and I need you to try and help to sort out a situation here. I don't want to tell you about it. Let's just go and you'll see what the parameters of it are when you're there. That should also be coupled with the fact that your demeanor as you go with these others and their demeanor should also be to win the individual rather than condemn the individual. You're not a deputation from the Boilermakers. You are going as friends trying to help someone out of a dangerous position that they've got themselves into. As this wider discussion progresses, always be ready, though, to acknowledge or repent of anything you might have done wrong or any part of your understanding that may have been complete, and be ready to say, look, I didn't understand that. I'm sorry, I made a mistake there. Because you want to come out of this closer to this person than you were before you went into it. Again, I'd say that in dealing with really converted people, the number of times that both of those steps, going on your own and then widening the discussion to include one or two others, the number of times that both of those steps would fail would be very, very low indeed. Therefore, the third step should really be seen as a last resort. Matthew 18:17 says, and if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. If the individual, despite the increased pressure, refuses to move and refuses to acknowledge or repent in any way, then we're told to tell it to the church. I do not believe for one second that what we're being told to do here is do a round of all the members. I think it should be best understood as referring to the church government. In other words, at this time, this is the point where you have to involve the ministry, because the final outcome of someone refusing to listen, even to the ministry, would inevitably be disfellowshipment, which of necessity, of course, involves the minister. I think it's worth reminding ourselves, though, that disfellowshipment itself isn't merely a reprisal or a punishment. It's a means of exerting a bit more pressure on the individual to bring about repentance and forgiveness and restoration. So steps 1, 2, and 3, where the person becomes at least temporarily debarred from attending services, they are all to bring about the restoration of the individual. You know, read 1 Corinthians, read 2 Corinthians about the individual who had been having some sort of illicit relationship with his mother-in-law or something. And Paul says, put him out. And then he tells them in 2 Corinthians, bring them back. This guy's repented. He's changed. I'm so pleased. He's been restored. That's good. That's what the whole thing's about. I'd also like to say that I'm not giving this material because I think we've got a problem here in this process. I'm giving this material because I believe it's traditionally, ever since I came into the church nearly 45 years ago, it's always been a problem area in the church. Finally, we should bear in mind that context that we spoke of at first, and that Christ stressed the need for humility, gentleness, a concern for one another, never seeking to be hurtful, never seeking to be offensive, never seeking to be vindictive, always wanting the best for the other person. Hopefully, we can see that if that's our approach, if that's our purpose, then faithfully doing what Christ tells us there in Matthew 18 should result in closer, more harmonious, more supportive congregations in God's church. And who wouldn't want that?